I'm Chris Sharon, and that's together with my wife Sonia. I'm helping to coordinate the teaching staff this summer, and the teaching staff each week hosts a community forum on something important that we're facing in church and society. And tonight we're talking about where we are as a Lutheran church, but if you're not Lutheran, have no fear. Most other churches haven't solved this either. How we're struggling together about walking with and welcoming, ordaining, blessing relationships for gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender brothers and sisters. And one element of that is the Lutheran Church right now is studying a draft statement on human sexuality as a whole, a part of which is that question about welcome, the extension of welcome, and how we go about that for GLBT people. So Merritt Chelsett on our teaching staff is on the sexuality task force and has been a part of writing that.
We have tasks for all of you.
Yes. No. And Mary Albing is here, and she's a pastor at a church in Minneapolis, and remarkably has
still
stayed on the roster, despite her partnership and public partnership. Is it safe to say?
Very
public.
We were on the front page of the Star Tribune.
So her story comes into this conversation from the perspective of pastoral leadership in a congregation. And how many of you have read the draft social statement?
Part of it? Even
just read the introduction. Okay, so maybe up to half the group. What we want to do is just hear some from the two of our panelists from their perspectives, setting the conversation off, and then welcome in comments and questions and strike up a conversation together. So hopefully we'll all have more on our mind than we're able to say tonight and can go from here with new perspectives and inspiration to go register a response to the draft before November 1st. What I wanted to do after they have a chance each to say something is to, in small groups, talk together for a few minutes so everyone has a chance to respond together in small groups of two or three to what they've shared, and then come back together in a larger group with comments out of the conversations you've had with one another. That way we won't spend the whole time just in a big group conversation where a smaller number of the people present here have a chance to say something. So that's what I hope we'll do. By way of introduction to this draft social statement, I just want to say the reason that the library copy that we have available for people to read was appended by some unknown person to say another draft social statement on human sexuality, the ELCA has been pretty much working on a human sexuality statement since its formation in the late 1980s. And the first draft human sexuality statement came out in 1993, at the time when Karen Blomquist was leading the studies department. So quite a few years later, we're still at it with another draft before us. And I think in my first book was on the Lutheran Church's struggles over marriage and homosexuality, as I titled it. It was titled Married in the Sight of God. And I read everything that the Lutheran Church had publicly said in the 20th century on these topics. And one of the things that struck me is that we're at a place now, I think, where we have the best thing before us since the study that led up to the sex, marriage, and the family social statement. And the social statement itself, I don't think, was as good as the study document that preceded it. And that came out of, again, a very long period all the way through the 1960s and into the 70s before the LCA was able to come up with the social statement on human sexuality. So I'm really delighted with where we are in general, and I've expressed my gratitude to Merit for the work she's done on it. And so I want to add my encouragement to all of you who haven't had a chance to read it. It could be better, but what we have is a really remarkable moment, I think, a remarkable document that could lead us to some really interesting places. And I encourage you to take the time to read it and to read at this website, elca.org, Journal of Lutheran Ethics. There's a whole set of responses from pastors, from theologians, and so forth. So you can formulate your own response, but you can also go here and engage in some dialogue with other people who are responding to it as a sort of second layer of the conversation, taking it a little bit deeper. So,
Chris, can I ask you a timeline question?
Sure.
On that, so then I guess is the hope that the responses then come in and that this will be voted in at the Synod Assemblies next May, and then at the national, or, I mean, how does that timeline move forward?
The responses will come in, the final draft will come out in January or February, and then the vote will be in August.
Okay, so it'll be at each Synod Assembly when they have theirs, and
I don't know how that voting, I think it goes to the floor at the national churchwide.
Okay, so
assembly.
It does not go to
the
Synod.
Yeah, no. It just goes to church.
But what happens in practice is that groups who are interested in one way or another will memorialize that large assembly. So people, I expect it would come up at synods in a variety of ways.
Mm-hmm. And my hope in having both Marriott and Merritt speak is that we get sort of the perspective of a teaching theologian who's on the task force and the perspective of a pastor who, from a congregational leadership position, is really seeing how this is playing out. And so we get right from the start a couple of different perspectives on where we are now, and then adding in your thoughts and perspectives as well. So,
you want me to start?
Do you have a preference?
I don't care.
Okay.
Well, there are always the official documents, like Chris was talking about, and then there are the unofficial things that are how life really is in the church, I think. I was ordained in 1988 and served several congregations with my former husband, also an ELCA pastor. We served actually 13 congregations, doing both part and full-time ministry, and then also a lot of interim. So I've worked in congregations that were worshiping 10 on Sunday morning and 800 or 900. And when I got to 40 years old, came to myself, and I came out, and that was in 99. And at that time, there wasn't a prayer, a finding, a parish position for an ELCA person who'd come out and fully intended to have a partner. I came out to my bishop at the time. Eventually, family, you're always coming out to somebody. I'm coming out right now, but there was sort of a process. Came out to everybody I could think of, and ended up in chaplaincy. And over 5 years' time, while I was doing chaplaincy and supervising CPE students, the church changed enough, I think, that a small congregation in Minneapolis took the very deliberate step of interviewing whomever they chose. Some people were straight, some people were gay. They got suggestions from members of the congregation as well as from the synod. And I was made aware of the process and was invited into it and received a call there 5 years ago. The whole time I was in conversation with yet another bishop who made a lot of threats but didn't actually end up doing too much. They sort of wrestled with it. I'm technically on leave of call. The congregation the pulpit is vacant, and I say some Sundays that's more true than others. And when I tried to review that, or, you know, when it came up for review after 3 years, which is what happens with rostered people, it went to the Conference of Bishops, who tabled it. So I've never been thrown off the roster. I'm still officially rostered with the ELCA. This is all to say that every gay person's story is so different. Some people who were never partnered even were invited to leave their positions. Although technically you're okay, supposedly, if you're celibate. That's not true in practice in many of our synods, I don't think. I somehow have survived, even though I've come out to two bishops and put it in all my paperwork, and those of you who are clergy or attached to them or have gone through this call process know you have to sign off on mobility papers on vision and expectations, and I checked the wrong box, we'll say, and then I wrote an explanation saying it's a long document, and no pastor would ever survive it if you actually literally took it so literally. And I said, but I know what the intention is here, and so I'm checking, you know, I'm checking the box that you would expect me to. Still didn't get thrown off the roster, and I've survived this long. So that's just to tell you a little bit. I've been in ministry for 20 years. In a variety of settings, and my partner Jane is a church musician, so between us we've worked in paid positions for congregations for over 50 years. And what I tell other Lutheran clergy who are coming out and are partnered is, you belong as much as the rest of those turkeys, so just act like you belong.
I don't understand how you got called to that church, but you're not the pastor.
I am. And that's part. I was called by the same process you all call your pastors. I filled out all the paperwork. The bishop refused to sign it. And I was put on leave from call. And so technically, they don't have a pastor, but I'm there 60 hours a week.
And they pay me.
And they pay me, which is important. And what I found was so interesting is really financially, you know, everybody's worried I was going to lose my insurance, or, you know, people, you know, catastrophized about it. And my mother thought I was going to be sitting on the curb any day with a little cup, you know. And people really worried, but, you know, there's health insurance in the ELCA for people who are not rostered, so anyway, so I would just kind of hang in there.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, so I teach at Pacific Lutheran University for a job, and I got drafted onto the task force in 2005, and to any group, at least to student groups, so I guess to here as well and to other places when I'm asked to speak on Christianity and homosexuality or sexuality, I always begin by saying I am an ally, and I have a lot of people that I hold myself accountable to in the GLBT community. And so when they called to ask me if I would be on the task force, I said I was ineligible because I had essentially left the Lutheran Church for about a decade over being frustrated with this issue, and had just, and in a way, being on the task force was my welcome home to the ELCA. So I thought, well, if I'm going to stand on the sidelines and, you know, gripe about this, and I'm being called to ask to serve, I thought, well, I guess I need to. And my partner, my spouse, Bjorn, I said, this could be dangerous, actually. You know, we've got little kids. So I was like, I kind of need your permission. Because I think some people had been threatened on the previous task force. And he said, let them come. You know, he was like, bring them on. Bring on the crazies. I'll write letters back to them. And I was like, okay. So, but what you should know is, as a task force member, when I said I'm ineligible because I'm too biased, they said, no, we need you because you'd fill that position. So I filled that position on the task force.
The two-biased
position. The two-biased position. And there are others who, what you should know is the task force, I think there's fear on all sides that the task force is mono-minded in some way. You know, it's either the deck is stacked with a bunch of liberals or the deck is stacked with a bunch of people trying to bar the door. And there are some of all. And people on different kinds of spectrums, and so I am on it, but my position doesn't represent the perspective of all the task force members, so you should know that. I think it's fair to say that. So whatever position you're coming from, that there is voice on the task force for a lot of different positions. What I've had primarily to do with in the writing of the third study and with this draft social statement on human sexuality is the theological framework that we're trying to set up and where you start theologically and where that's going to bring you. And we have talked about a lot of different starting places in Lutheran theology and fought over them. And so that is where some of my passion has come in, because I think where you start theologically makes a difference. So I've had something to do with that. Part of my perspective as a task force member, if I'm to speak personally, is that I wish that the document was seen by the, 85, I don't know what percent heterosexual we are in our church, but I wish that the heterosexual community would take it seriously and see how it acts as both a blessing and indictment of their sexual practices. I wish it was directed that direction, personally. I really do wish that people were taking it seriously as, what are we all doing sexually in our own lives, individually, and with our partners, no matter who they are. Because it might have some good, it may or may not have some ethical things, and it is supposed to be about human sexuality, and I think listening to people talk about it, I get so frustrated that it seems like all the heterosexuals are off the, they don't really even have to think about their sexuality because they're just so busy fixating gay or lesbian or bisexual, transgender sexuality, that there's very little self-reflection, and that's so disturbing to me. So I wish that this was truly about human sexuality, and then that this is supposed to be this kind of philosophical statement or whatever, theological statement that sets up policy is something that can engender policy for the next 20 years. So you think... And then our recommendations on specific policies are supposed to follow it. They're not supposed to be in it. So, I would assume that some of you, like me, would like a lot more recommendations and statements to be made in here. And some of them are in there about prostitution, about... the media and things like that. There are statements. There are some statements in there, so maybe there should just be a whole lot more in there. But it is one of those things where you struggle with, like, is this the place for statements? Do you make a list of statements? Because then no one will read anything except that list of statements, actually. Do you work the statements into the document? All those kinds of things. But there will be this, and then there will be a separate set of recommendations on policy for the ELCA that will be voted on separately, that also is supposed to come from the task force as of the last churchwide assembly. And neither the Lutherans concerned nor the task force are happy about that chart, because the task force does not have time. It made recommendations, good or bad, whatever we think, in 2005, and it spent years coming up with them, where now the task force is supposed to be writing the document and then also doing these recommendations. And there's a whole new set of people who have come onto the task force, and there were a number of people on the task force who said, what can we do to not we are not the people who should be creating these recommendations, you know. We don't have time to talk about it as a group. We don't have the years to think about it as far as coming up with that. They already did that, and a lot of people wanted to quit. And we're really mad about having that throw, and, you know, they said, yeah, we've got to create this statement, and now this other set of recommendations, they will come, they have to, because we were told we have to come up with them. And you don't, and I guess you can't say no or pass it off to somebody else, because church-wide it is the governing body. So that's that process. So this is supposed to be this general statement about human sexuality. But.
And the recommendations go to the church council, right?
This time, yeah, they can, I think, edit and work through them too before they move on.
Right. So what I want to do is they've just out of two experiences shared some starting reflections, and I want people to talk together with those next to you about if there's something in what they said that connected with your passion or grabbed your attention or made you think something new. Focus on where you felt energy and connection to what they were saying, and share with one another a little bit about that. We'll take a few minutes to do that as a way to sort of let the directions and questions that you want to lift up have time to percolate before we come back into large group conversation. So I'll leave about 5 minutes for that, and then we'll have 30 minutes together as a large group. Yeah.
When we come back, can we just, for the people who haven't read the statement, maybe, Mary, you could very, very briefly sketch out what it says.
Foundation. Yeah. I could do that right this minute, if you want me to. Let me see it. And I've been the one on the task force that's like, we need a thesis statement. I want it in a paragraph.
Let's come back to that after people talk.
All right.
Because it's almost 50 pages with footnotes, so it's actually a pretty substantial document. And if we get into summarizing it now, then I think it's going to take away from a whole range of things that people might be feeling and thinking right now in response to what you've said.
Right.
And we can do that as a part of our, when we come back, if that's important to do, we can do that. But let's take a few minutes now and talk to one another. And that may be something that you have energy about and want to come back to. There may be other things too. So 5 minutes, and we'll come back at 9:00. You can stay right where you are, but talk with those. Let's invite everybody in to a broader conversation. I'd like to invite you to consider a couple of ground rules for larger group conversation. One of which is to try and keep what you offer brief. There's lots of stories that we bring to these kinds of conversations. And for all of us, stories are important, but in this context, when there's lots of people participating in the conversation, as brief as you can keep the comment or question that you want to make, it also then is hospitable to other people who want to share as well. I also want to encourage people not to comment positively or negatively on what other people say, but to just offer what you have to say and make it a space in which lots of people can share what their perspective is, what they're thinking, what they're questioning. And then lastly, I want to make sure that if you have a particular question or comment that you want to direct to one of the two of our panelists up here, that you go ahead and just say who you would like to respond to it. Just be real clear with your request, and they'll respond to it as best they can. So let's just see where we are. I heard lots of vibrant conversation, and I'm glad for that. And so out of that, what sorts of issues or questions or comments emerge that you would like to put before all of us as we talk together?
Can I ask an ignorant question?
Yeah.
To be a reconciling church, can you explain that terminology and how that relates to the Lutheran church? I mean, does that, when we say that we're a reconciling church, does that have anything to do with sexual preference? It's an ignorant question. I don't know enough about it.
Reconciling in Christ is a movement and an organization within the ELCA. It was started probably 25 years ago, I think, 20 or 25 years ago. It's a process. You can go to a website and look it up, and you can get someone who lives in or near your community to come and help your congregation go through a process that includes two or three people coming and just telling their stories about what it's like to be gay and lesbian, and or to have a family member who's gay or lesbian. There's usually a theological or biblical kind of component. You know, how do we think about sexuality in the Bible, and especially gay and lesbian people in the Bible? And the end of the process, and they usually encourage people to take a year or two to do it. The congregation typically votes on a statement of inclusion, and they encourage you to publicize it in your community. We have the front of our bulletin, for example, the name of the church, and the very next line says, "We are a reconciling in Christ community. Everyone is welcome to worship with us." And so they give you some encouragement about strategies and that sort of thing. It connects you, can connect your congregation with other reconciling in Christ congregations, so that there are sometimes sort of like fairs or something that they put on that to help you strategize to add more congregations to that organization and so on.
Thank you. That's a
You'd refer in call papers to vision expectations. What was it? I mean, to be rostered clergy, that you have to sign off on
this document.
Okay. What's specific in that document? I'm just.
Maybe you've been working on more than.
On visions and expectations. Well, there's a statement. It basically says, here are the requirements for, here are the expectations of the pastoral role. Financial management, all kinds of things about how you run your life and interact with your congregation. And then it says, and if you are a heterosexual person, you will remain celibate until you are, unless you are married. And that if you are gay or lesbian, that you will you'll be celibate. You can be a pastor, but you sign off to saying, I'll be celibate. So that's the part of visions and expectations that will also be depending on what happens. If anything happens in August this year, then that would also, I believe, have to go back and review that as well.
It's only a sentence.
It's a tiny little statement. It's a pretty
out of
it's not a huge
12 pages. Yeah. Or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, our bishop has talked to me about it. He said it's actually because they drafted that for whatever all the reasons were. It's actually given some synods a little more traction with dealing with other kinds of problems that pastors have sometimes.
Fidelity issues.
I was making an observation. I think it was kind of some of the conversation we were having about really the process and how difficult or maybe impossible it's going to be for the church as a whole through a statement or policy is going to be able to change, because there's so many viewpoints and so much history and so many people work very firm in their positions. But then struck by the example that you shared and realizing that maybe that's how change is going to have to happen. It's going to be congregation by congregation,
yeah.
willing to take that stand and go out and call a person such as yourself who they want to be their pastor, because that's the main thing. You know, there's a call there. That's what's going to drive it. And then maybe that'll go up to the synod levels, and some synods will take that action. It's going to, you know, bishops already who are not signing, they're not taking reprimanding, they're not following, you know, necessarily, or they're looking the other way. But it's going to be a bottom-up process probably rather than a top-down process.
Another question for Mayor.
Yeah.
Jim Wilkerson, Pilgrim Lutheran, Puyallup, Washington. You mentioned earlier about some of your top of your struggles on the committee with where to start in scripture or theology. Would you share what your feelings are about where that should, what the basis, the theological basis should be?
Sure. I think there are a lot of places to start in theology, and we talked about theology of the cross, we talked about law and gospel, of using that kind of language. We talked about a number of different beginning points, creation, where all these lead to, whether the language is relevant at all, whether anyone, any of us sitting in the room would consider our, I mean, as a, you know, you write these things, but then you have to step back and say, do I really walk around thinking about my sexuality in terms of law and gospel? Like, or is that just kind of nonsense? I mean, or does it just seem like, does anybody do that? And so there are those times where you think, like, you need it to be a Lutheran document, but we also have to choose to be relevant or irrelevant. Hopefully we say something that has some merit beyond Lutherans. And I work with 18 to 22-year-old students. They don't know what... They don't know what these terms mean, and they don't think of their sexuality in those terms. So if I want to talk Lutheran talk to them, then I'm going to have to put that into different kinds of phrases. Where it came about with, because we talked about justification by faith and trust in God's promises as the... as a key pillar, and because trust is a term that's used, and because Luther, when he talks about justification by faith, he's using the term that's also the word for trust in God's promises, and trust is essential. The statement argues based on that trust is essential to good sexual relationships. So that Lutherans actually might have something in our theology about the foundation of trust that comes all the way down from God into all of our relationships that can provide a safe place for human sexuality to, a safe and healthy place for human sexuality. And things that don't build trust can be called on the carpet. I think if I was going to say a summary of what some of the things were intended to come out, whether that's clear in the document, I don't know. But so that starting point and incarnation and embodiment and beginning with those starting places. But there is discussion over all the different possible starting places, and lots of people have offered, you know, what they think it should start with after that. So I'm saying, you know, this isn't where it should start, you know, so... yes, there should be, it could be said that some people might want to start with creation, which would be a good place in a lot of ways for things to begin if you're going to talk about incarnation. But the problem is that it's been used, that starting place has been used to formulate a kind of legalism around human sexuality. And nobody on the task force, from whatever position they were coming from, wanted to make a Lutheran document on sexuality legalistic. That they said, that's not our starting place. Actually, Roman Catholicism has this great logic, and you build from the ground up, and then you can go, ta-da! You know, here you've got this great logic and this lineup, and there's the law. Where Lutheranism has always had a different... We don't begin with legalism. And I thought, well, this is interesting. People from all different positions on the task force don't necessarily want to come up with a thou shalt document. I thought, well, So Maybe that's totally out of sync with the rest of the church, though. Maybe.
Sort of a detailed question. One of the stronger things that came out of Eppley as a kind of a recommendation or prohibition was against cohabitation, whether for heterosexuals or homosexuals. And I was wondering why cohabitation is equated with heterosexual relations. That seemed like a pretty big assumption.
I think it's just a good comment. Do you want me to say anything on that?
I'm sorry whether there was some logic behind that or whether it was just a
Well, you know, no, Chris, you can correct me on this, but no other document has even included the fact that we'll say anything about people who are cohabiting. And so that, whether it's same sex or other sex cohabitation outside of marriage, if it includes sexuality, I think people thought couples who would choose to cohabit permanently, I think that it's a good point to say these could be sexual or non-sexual relationships. I suppose in the document you're trying to address ones that are sexual.
I guess permanence didn't seem to be necessarily a part of it, of this cohabitation. I don't know, it just seemed really
original. Well, it needs to be fleshed out more, too. But it isn't, well, that kind of got in like the last year. People said, what about, you know, well, do we want to apply the same? We've talked about same-sex committed relationships. Are we going to set the same set of expectations, visions and expectations for other sexed cohabiting relationships that are not, people who are not married who are in partnerships?
So
who are other sex?
Is a code word.
What's
or
that?
Cohabitation is a code word.
Yes. Not just sharing the same, not roommates.
Living together and in a romantic relationship with sexual intercourse.
Mm-hmm.
That's what that means.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But it comes out strongly against cohabitation.
Strongly
against. That definition.
I don't know.
What's the exact stance on that?
What is the exact stance of the document?
No, on cohabitation.
Yes, of the documents.
It might be helpful if you just spell out the basic logic of the relationship between trust and sexual intimacy that the statement talks
Bill?
About.
Yeah. Chris, you go ahead and do that. I want to write the cohabitation. No, you studied it. I want to write about the non-sexualized roommates. What exactly
is
intended by?
I mean, there's being sexual and there's having sexual relations.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another thing in the statement that's maybe not so clear. It does talk about we know what we think about sexual relations most of the time, but things that are not things that are not intercourse, we don't really know what we think about that. I think those distinctions make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's partly a way to avoid talking specifically about a variety of kinds of sexual acts. But the document unfolds this logic based on this basic idea of trust that says the more intimate the sexual relationship, the more trust or the higher level of trust that ought to be there as a partner to that deeper level of sexual intimacy, and the document portrays lifelong committed relationships as the ultimate level of trust. And so in that context, they talk about sort of the full expression of sexuality. And I think that is different than what statements before have said, because they've said basically only sex within marriage and not, this is really strange, just talking about all this with right in the center.
should they please, actually, statement even goes as far as saying, you know, there are still states where after you've lived together for a while, you're assumed married under the law. You're legally married as far as the government is concerned.
But that logic creates a way of saying, actually, certain kinds of sexual interactions may be fine. And there may be levels of trust that make that acceptable. And it gives a way of thinking morally and faithfully about a range of relationships and a range of kinds of sexual interaction that I haven't seen in our teaching before. And that just feels more real to me. Instead of pretending that no one has sex except married people. And that assumes married people have sex. I mean, it's built into the traditional wooden ways that we talk about this. And my concern is any step we can take toward being more real about this is helpful.
And so, it does keep saying that, I mean, as far as like, it keeps saying the church has had this tradition of saying that that sex should be in the context of marriage. And the document says this, we affirm this. However, sex is not happening only in the context of marriage. In all contexts, this is the expectation. So it tries to talk about what has been affirmed, and then to say, but this isn't, we need to speak to all these contexts and then what kind of expectations people have. I think the church and maybe our culture really does have a romanticization, if that's the word, of sex in marriage. And so you will see that here and there. And what you should do is read through the document and find all the places that you find it inconsistent and bring those to the table. Write letters to the task force. They get read. They actually get sent to our houses. They are read, I swear to you. If you send it to the task force, it goes to every single one of us individually. They will send it from churchwide, and it comes in my mailbox. So be, then my spouse can write you letters. Only if you're crazy. So be crazy, give him something to do.
There's a hand here.
It was already kind of answered.
Okay.
Okay. I have a question about the actual task force. You said that there was a lot of different opinions on the task force. What about age groups? Is everything represented, or is it?
I've been told I'm young. I want you to talk because you're young. I'm like 41. I guess I feel all kind of young, but I actually am not. No, there's actually somebody who's basically like grown up on the task force. She's no longer young, actually. So in the last 9 years, she's grown up. She used to be the, voice of youth, and now she's the voice of single, out of permanently partnered relationships, but I think that's how she might define herself. But there's youth representatives. There are a couple of youth representatives, people who work with youth directors, and then there's some age range. Mm-hmm. Yeah, occupation, location, urban, rural perspective. They tried to balance out a bunch of things, however successfully.
Sure.
Somebody else had said about living into this. I just personally wish it didn't have to be voted on. It just creates such an adversarial way of dealing with this. And I think about, there was a time in former the predecessor bodies where if you were divorced, you were gone. And we've lived into realizing that, times change and scripture is looked at in different ways. And I just so wish that we could live into this that way instead of having to come back every time and vote. It just sets up a very adversarial way of looking at this. And I also wish that people would say this is about people and not about an issue.
Thanks. Other questions or comments or perspectives?
One thing we talked about is how long it is.
How long the statement is.
Could it be simpler?
Yeah.
It's if it gets passed, it's by far the longest social statement on sexuality that movements have done. So it is remarkably longer than other social statements that we've done.
And actually,
well, she's laughing.
Or any kind of statement.
Well, like we have a couple of other social statements that we've passed that are quite lengthy, the education statement and the one on creation. And so it's representative of the length of some of the other the ELCA social statements, but the LCA especially was a couple pages, very brief. And the ALC statement was a little longer, but maybe 10 pages. So any comment on the length?
Well, isn't most of it explanation?
What's that?
Isn't most of it explaining the stance?
Yeah, but it's spelled, it just takes its time spelling it out in a way that the other...
That's because a lot of people have so many questions about it that I think that's necessary.
Maybe it's a change, though.
I think in the future, that many pages will probably not be needed, but I'd say at this point, it is probably a good thing. Even if people don't want to read the whole thing, if they're really interested, they'll read it. I think I read the whole thing.
Yeah, Ron.
Mary, I can only appreciate the challenge of working on the task force. I've read through the statement, and we've had a clergy discussion in the Seattle area over it. And it really does come to the length. But there about half of it lays out the whole Lutheran premise, you know, theological, ethical, and then the more sociological and practical applications. Mm-hmm. And I just found a disconnect between the two. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was very little reference from the second half back to the first half, except for this dimension of trust. Mm-hmm. And if we want to shorten it, I think it felt like it was just a Lutheran smorgasbord. Mm-hmm. Of that we got to cover every point of our major tenets in Lutheranism, mm-hmm. and everybody has to wade through that first to get to the meat of the document. And if somehow that could be reduced to two or three pages, mm-hmm. emphasizing the trust element and the love element, and then move on to the substance of the document, mm-hmm. I just think it would be much more helpful.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Say more about how you didn't see a connection between the second half and the theological unfolding the first part.
Well, I didn't look it up it up here.
But that was your impression.
That was my impression. You know, when we talk about law and gospel, there was no reference back to the word gospel or the law in the second half of the document. You know, are we talking about law here when the statement says, you know, cohabitation is frowned upon by the church? You know, is that law or is that gospel? You were left to figure that out. Well, if there's just...
I think generally the more specific you get about things, the more it feels like law instead of themes.
I must say that a lot of people, when I should have said, I'm wishing that whoever had asked that question was still here, because when we have, when all the law and gospel stuff comes up, if the law is what functions to reveal sin in the world, I think there's a ton of that in the document, looking at how we use human sexuality in ways that damage ourselves and each other. I mean, it's everywhere in there. So we get this kind of comment of, it doesn't have enough law. And it's like, what do you mean by law? I mean, what do you mean that in, like, the civic use of the law? Or do you mean that in what serves to reveal sin? Because I think that's kind of our primary, you know, definition in some ways. So that's everywhere. We're talking about the ways syphilis. But yeah, but there's, yeah, so that integration, that's helpful, and it's something we talk about too.
We're at 9:30, and I hope there's more conversation to be had, and some people have already signaled they want some time with our panelists to talk a little more. But let's thank them and call it an official close to the evening, and if some of you want to stay and talk more, you're welcome to. But thank you very much for having us.